University of Toronto, and he will be talking about chord diagrams, knots, and Lie algebras.
Okay. So, first of all, just this will be totally a service talk. It's not about current research. It's about stuff that was available that existed 25 or 30 years ago. And really what I want to tell you is about how the exact same type of chord diagrams appear both in knot theory and in Lie theory. Okay, and again, it's old material. Some of you know it very, very well. So anyway, thanks for inviting me to this session. And the video that I'm taking and also the handout the handout is already available at this URL, and the video will be available too. And as I said, the talk follows the handout. That's what it looks like. Each one of you should hold a copy. Just an aside about how this talk is organized. So I learned indirectly from a rather well-known mathematician that the most fun thing to write is book reviews, because it's not refereed, so you can put your opinion on whatever you care in the first four pages, and then you add one page with a few words about the book, and you're done, and you've done something that you wanted to do. So when I was preparing for this talk, I realized, oh my God, I once wrote a book review based on this philosophy. So the part of the book review that has nothing to do with the book is what I'm going to talk about. Or not nothing to do with the book. The book is about that, but it's my own wording of that book. So it's also my first time ever to give a talk in which the slides are the literal text of a book review. Anyway, so, about 36 years or 40 years ago, let's say, if you had told anyone, the most informed mathematician, that there is a relationship between knots and Lie algebra, and Lie algebras, they would laugh at you. It's ridiculous. I mean, they look completely different. It's like trying to mix crystals and worms. You know, both are lovely scientific topics. You can study both of them, but they don't meet. What's the relationship? Okay, so knots look like this. They're smooshy. They're like, I don't know, gritty. I don't know what. Whereas Lie algebras are completely different. They're algebraic. They're symmetries. They look different. Why on earth would they be related? Okay, and I want to tell you in a very brief language how they get related. And the answer is that there is a certain space of chord diagrams, A, in the center. And that space is, in some sense, dual to the dual of the space of knots. And in some other sense, dual to the space of Lie algebras. And if you count the dualities here, then it follows that for Lie algebraic informations, you should get a function on knots. So knot invariants. And that's what I want to tell you about. Anyway, but let's start. So let's start. The dual to the space of knots is the space of functions on knots, or also known as knot invariants. Okay, a function on the set of knots is simply a knot invariant. Now, I want to talk about a specific type of functions on the space of knots, which are sort of like polynomials. But they're not, it's not that they take values in polynomials, but they are polynomials. They behave as if they are polynomials on the set of knots. Instead of polynomials on the real numbers, they're polynomials on knots. So here is how it is defined. So let V be an arbitrary invariant of oriented knot and orientable space with values in some abelian group, let's say the rational numbers. And whenever you have such an invariant, you can extend it to knots that have a single double point by just declaring, so a double point is a thing like that, two strands cut through each other. And by just declaring that the value of the invariant on a knot that has a double point is the value of the invariant on the knot that you get by replacing the double point with an overcrossing minus the value of the invariant on the knot that you get by replacing the double point by an undercrossing. And if you're not familiar, there is a certain right-hand rule to distinguish between over and under. Okay, so, you know, if you hold the upper strand with your right hand in a certain way, anyway, it doesn't really matter what it is. There is such a rule, okay? The moment you extended to knot with a single double point, to knot with a single double point, you can continue and extend to knots with two double points or three double points by induction. And it's easy to show that this is well defined. And namely, it doesn't matter in which order you extend, in which order do you go through the double points. And then you think of it like differentiation. So the knot here and the knot here differ in only one place, or like they're nearby knots. And derivatives are differences of values on nearby points. So you think of it like a combinatorial analog of a derivative. So the value on a knot, the value of the invariant on a knot with one double point is like a first derivative of the original invariant. And then you say that an invariant is of type M, or Vasiliev of type M, or finite type of type M, if it is like a polynomial of degree M. Namely, if when you extend it to knot with M plus one singular points, double points, so M plus one singular knots, it vanishes identically. Like saying that a polynomial is a polynomial if it's n of degree m if its n plus first derivative is identically zero. That's one way to define polynomials. Now, it's reasonable to conjecture that, like polynomials in ordinary space, polynomial or knots are dense in the space of all knot invariants. So, in some sense, it's reasonable to conjecture that, well, or at least that finite-type invariants are separate knots. This is a conjecture. We don't know it. We don't know if this is true. But we do know that we're talking about a very large class of invariants. There are many, many, many examples. And again, this is a short talk, so I will not tell you much about it. But this is, when I say the dual of the space of knots, I actually mean only the finite-type invariant, so the part of the dual that is polynomial in some sense. Okay? Now, I want to try to find all finite-type invariants. And the idea is similar to how you go with polynomials. So if you have a polynomial of degree m, if you want to study all polynomials of degree m, one thing you can do is you can study their mth derivatives. Their mth derivatives, suppose these are polynomials on Rn, they have many mth derivatives, okay? But if you have two polynomials of degree m, and they have the same mth derivatives, then they differ by a polynomial of degree m minus 1. And this, so presumably, you might have studied yesterday. So if you want to study inductively polynomials of degree m, it's enough to study their mth derivative. So let's declare that v up m is the restriction of v to m singular knot, namely it's the collection of all evaluations of v on knots that have precisely m double points. So I want to understand these. Now, the mth derivative of a degree m polynomial is constant. And likewise, here there is a sense of there is a notion of constancy. So if you evaluate v on a knot which has m double points and an additional double point, an additional overcrossing, and then you subtract v evaluated on the same m double points and an additional undercrossing, the difference, by definition, is v evaluated on a knot that has m plus 1 double points, because over minus under is a double point, and this should be 0. I'm studying an invariant of degree m right now, which basically means that V no longer depends on the topology, because you can switch over crossings to undercrossings at no cost. The invariant doesn't change. So what does it depend upon? It only depends on the chord diagram that underlies the knot, or the singular knot. So here is a four singular knot. The chord diagram underlying it is written here on the right. How do you get it? Basically, you pick a base point, a starting point. Here it's denoted by an arrow, and here's the corresponding arrow here. The knot itself is a circle, so you draw a circle, and then you go along the knot, and you pass through point number one, then point number two, then point number three, then point number four, then number one again, then number two again. So you mark one, two, three, four, one again, two again, four again, three again on the circle, and you connect one to one, two to two, three to three, you get chords on a circle, and I think this is the first time that chord diagrams appear in the Chord Diagrams Everywhere session. Chord diagrams are just circles with chords on them. Okay? And what we just learned, okay, now, sorry, flipping over crossings or to under crossings on, so if I flip this crossing here from over to under, it doesn't change the chord diagram. Okay? So the invariant, so V up M, the nth derivative of V, does not change when I flip the crossings, and it's easy to show that what it means at the end is that it depends only on the chord diagram underlying the knot, the singular knot. So every degree M invariant defines a functional on chord diagrams with M chords, or on M chord diagrams, and that functional essentially determines the invariant. It determines it up to invariants of type M minus 1, right? Because it's like the nth derivative. Okay? Now, not every functional, so not every function on chord diagram comes from an invariant. There are some constraints. So I don't think I want to go through it because my time is limited, but there is a simple topological argument which says, well, okay, on the one, so suppose you have an invariant with a local picture that looks like this, sorry, a knot, a singular knot with a local picture that looks like this, namely, there is a double point and a lasso that goes around it and over everything. Well, you can pull the lasso out and then you can push it back in under, and that's the same knot. So V evaluated on both of these is the same, and therefore the difference between these two is zero. When I mean when you evaluate V on them, okay? On the other hand, you can get from here to here by flipping four crossings, one at a time. And at the end, this means that there is a relationship between the values on V on chord diagrams. It imposes a relationship on the nth derivative on V, which is a functional on chord diagrams. And then there is, so far everything is really easy and soft, but then come a relatively hard theorem, the Koncievich theorem, or the fundamental theorem of this theory of finite type invariants. And actually, if you want the details, you can go to the book, which I'm reviewing right now. and the theorem says the following. Let AM be the space of chord diagrams, of M chord diagrams, so that chord diagrams with M chords, modulo the 4T relation. So what I mean by that is you allow yourself linear combinations of chord diagrams, and you mod out by the 4T relation, which is drawn here, and which is just the chord diagrammatization of the topological relation written here. So AM is DM modulo this relation. If you have a functional on AM, it's really a functional on core diagrams, which vanishes on this relation. So it's a candidate to be the nth derivative of a type M invariant. And the theorem is that it is. So all type M invariants, all functionals of this type come from a type M invariant. So in some sense, AM is the dual to the space of type M invariants, which in itself is part of the dual to the space of knots. So AM is sort of the dual to the dual of the space of knots. Are you still with me? Good. Now we switch topics. On the other hand, that same space AM is also related to Lie algebras. And the first step is a theorem that I like to call the bracket rise theorem. It's where the bracket rises. So the theorem says that the space AM is isomorphic. Isomorphic means it's exactly the same. So I mean, once you understand the proof, it doesn't matter in which of them you talk. It's isomorphic to a space of slightly more complicated diagrams. So diagrams that again look like a circle. There might be chords on the circle, here is one, but there might be more complicated things. The more complicated things are called Jacobi diagrams, and they are trivalent graphs with a few conventions about signs, which maybe I should skip. But then you mod out by a different collection of relations. One relation is something, the anti-symmetry relation, it has to do with the sign. Another relation is the STU relation, which says that if you have a trivalent vertex connected by an edge to the circle, then you can replace it by either this picture or that picture with opposite signs. Okay? And there is an IHX relation which says that the letter I drawn from internal edges is equal to the letter H minus the letter X. Okay? And you, so again, the theorem is core diagrams modulo 40 are isomorphic to Jacobi diagrams modulo these three relations. I'm not going to go through the proof, except to say that it's really, really easy. So here is the core, the essence of the proof. So if you have a core diagram, so I've drawn part of the circle dashed to indicate that there might be more stuff there. But in particular, if you have, a Jacobi diagram with one trivalent vertex in it, you can get rid of it by using STU relations. The STU relations tell you how to get rid of trivalent vertices. So in fact, that defines a map from Jacobi diagrams to core diagrams, and that's one side of the isomorphism. But also, well, that map might appear to be not well defined, because I could use the STU relation either in this direction or in that direction. If I use it in this direction, I get this difference. And if I use it in the other direction, I get that difference. But the two are equal. This is precisely the 40 relation. So the map appears to be, or seems to be, well defined. And with a little bit more induction, you show that it's actually well defined. Anyway, the point is that these relations, these two relations resemble somehow Lie algebras. So, you know, a Lie algebra, should I say what a Lie algebra is? Or, you know, a Lie algebra is a vector space along, this requires more power than I thought. Maybe this should be
pointing at me now. Anyway,
so the algebra is a vector space G along with a bilinear form. So, bilinear operation. So a bracket, X bracket Y, which satisfies two relations. One is something to do with sine, so I don't care. And another one is related, is called the Jacobi identity, which says that X bracket Y bracket Z plus Y bracket X bracket, Z bracket X plus Z bracket X bracket Y is equal to zero. And the easiest way to get the algebra is if X and Y are say matrices and X bracket Y is defined to be XY minus YX. And the reason I mentioned it is because you can read the S in some sense, if you put X here and Y here, and you think of this line as ordering multiplication, then this reads as X times Y, and here the order is flipped, so it looks like minus Y times X, and the vertex, therefore, should be thought of as something like the bracket. And then, if you use the same language to interpret this picture, so you put X, Y, and Z, and think of the last end as input, as output, then this becomes the bracket of X and Y bracketed with Z is equal to, basically this becomes the Jacobi identity. So this is sort of informal, and you can turn it into something completely formal. Namely, given a finite dimensionally algebra, let's say a semi-simply algebra, along with a representation of it into some space of matrices, you choose an orthonormal basis, and this can be relaxed, X sub A for the Lie algebra, and some basis for the representation, so both should be finite dimensional. And then you use these bases to define the so-called structure constants of the Lie algebra. So FABC is really the bracket, is the information of the bracket. So you take the bracket of XA with XB and take its inner product with XC, and from this you can recover, since the X's form a basis, you can recover the bracket from these so-called structure constants. And similarly, R alpha beta A beta gamma is somehow an information from which you amount of information from which you can recover the representation. Namely, you simply write the representation on the element XA applied to the vector V beta. You write it as a linear combination of the V gammas, and the R gamma A B beta are the coefficients. And then suppose now you have a Jacobi diagram. So I took a very simple example, but everything works the same if the examples are more complicated. What you do is you label all the dashed lines, all the things that previously were chords, with Latin letters. You label the intervals along the circle with Greek letters, here alpha, beta, gamma, and you construct an expression out of this diagram. Namely, for each internal vertex, is surrounded by three Latin letters, so you take FABC, or you take F sub the three letters, so you write FABC, each vertex on the circle is surrounded by one Latin letter and two Greek letters, so you take the corresponding R tensor, and then you sum over all indices that appear, and this is a finite sum. And a very easy theorem says that, first of all, this is independent of all the choices, and secondly, again, basically, this is the bracket, and this is a matrix representation, so it satisfies the relations that brackets and matrix representation and matrix representation satisfy. Namely, it satisfies the relations in our space. Namely, given a Lie algebra and a representation, you get an element of the dual of Jacobi diagrams, which are isomorphic to chord diagrams. So you get an element of the dual of chord diagrams, as I've advertised in the beginning. And that's the end of the story. That's the simplest way that I know to see why these completely disjoint things, Lie algebras and knots, are actually closely related to each other. Thank you.
Are there questions? But I have one quick question.
Yeah.
So that's a very nice overview. Is, to the extent that chord diagrams play a role in these theories, is that aspect of it done, or are there
this
new
is
things
20,
to care about?
This is 25 years old
material.
Yeah, this
part is done, but in terms of, do chord diagrams still play a role?
Do chord yes, many, in many ways. I mean, of course, all of this is classical right now. Well, no, okay? But actually, you know, I never said that all functionals on chord diagrams come from Lie algebras. So many do, but in fact, not all come from Lie algebras. And it's not perfectly understood. It's sort of understood that that there are more functionals than Lie algebras, but we don't really understand how many, how much. So that's one answer completely for chord diagrams, okay? But an even better answer is that this generalizes in a huge number of directions, and instead of Lie algebras, you can talk about things that are called Lie bi-algebras or Poisson-Hopf algebras, or, you know, there are all sorts of algebraic gadgets that have similar diagrammatic theories associated with them that have similar similar topological theories associated with them. Two knots in four dimensions, various other things. So-called virtual knots, knots on surfaces. So there's a lot more to say, but, well, I mean, yeah.
All right, people may want to get to other talks, although I hope you'll stay. So let's thank Roy again.
Roy, can you turn this off? Good. Thank you.